So today is absolutely related to the project. You will see the charge exchange. It means in order to repeat the working cycle of a thermal engine, we have to replace the old charge and to have a new one, a fresh one. In order to discuss the whole story, of course, we need some basic functions and definitions. Okay, thank you. Do you remember Daniel Bernoulli? Okay, with his equation. Okay, Daniel Festi explained it to you. Okay. So it's not necessary to explain anything. Static pressure, dynamic pressure, hydrostatic pressure. Okay, all in. Fine. Some applications we are using it is, of course, an aircraft. Here you can see the airfoil of an aircraft at different angles of attack. In the background, you see the horizon. And if the pilot pulls the sticks, rising the nose, the point of flow separation is coming from the back to the front edge. So it's the flow separation. If you have a full flow separation, you won't have significant lift and the aircraft will go down. So this flow separation is for us a different story. It might happen in a turbocharger because it's the same. The turbocharger is not more functional in that area. But it might happen at high speeds, for example, in intake ports of the engine. And the effect for us, it will deteriorate the flow. So it will increase the flow resistance of the system and the air charge will be worse. So we try to keep the flow everywhere on the walls in the system, with a few exceptions. It will be very important for us. Let's say the speed of a pressure information in a gas is the speed of sound. So if the membrane of a loudspeaker pushes a few molecules, they will push the neighbors, and the speed of the information is sound speed. So since that, if you have, let's say, a pressurized air bottle, and you have a tiny hole on one side, the higher the pressure, the higher the air speed going out through the hole. What is the maximum speed you can achieve? What do you think? Speed of sound. In the narrowest section in the orifice, in the narrowest section, you can never exceed the sound speed because in order to have more flow in the same cross-section, the molecules inside the bottle need an information, need an idea that the ambient pressure, the outside pressure, is lower. Okay. Just imagine two huge bottles. Maybe I make a drawing. So you have a big bottle of pressurized air and the smaller one inside with an outlet. It's P2, it's P1. If P1 over P2 equals 1, nothing happens. Okay. Then you are increasing the pressure ratio, the flow starts to go out. And roughly about 2.6, 2.7, not a very high pressure ratio, you will reach the sound speed in the narrowest section there. And from this point on, any further reduction of the outside pressure, P2, will not affect, and no information can go into the bottle because the information is going with sound speed, the air is coming with sound speed, and the information stops. So the molecules inside have no clue that you reduced the pressure outside. Is it clear? And the sound speed depends, for us engineers, only from the absolute temperature. Okay, not the pressure, the temperature, square root of the absolute temperature. It's proportional to that. So it's very important. You will see we have several points in a combustion engine or a heat engine where we might be limited by the sound speed. Okay. The same story, you can have it. Of course, sometimes it is required, necessary, or it's practical to have higher flow speeds than sound speed. If we have aircraft, they are going faster than sound speed. What should we do in order to achieve a higher speed of the outgoing air than sound speed? If we are working, let's say, like a Venturi in first attempt, what will happen? The flow slows down. The pressure goes up. And it's a Venturi. If we have a clever shape of that, it's more that shape, something will happen. If we have already sound speed in this region, you will have pressure waves going outside. These pressure waves will be reflected from that surface to the right. And they are now bothering the molecules, go faster, go faster. So it's the so-called Laval nozzle. Monsieur Laval, another French guy, invented it. And you can accelerate the airflow far beyond sound speed, but not in the narrowest section. The narrowest section, no way, it's only sound speed achievable. Okay.
So we can increase it more than sound speed?
Yes. And the air will expand, the pressure will go down, the temperature will go down. It depends on the shape of this nozzle and the original speed. You have to be near to sound speed in this smallest orifice. Okay, if you have a look, nearly all rockets have this type of nozzle in the back. And now, my very important question for you engineers. If I want to fly with my aircraft faster than sound speed, is it necessary to accelerate the gas flow of the jet engine above sound speed? Who is for yes? Raise your hands. No. One. Who is for no? One, two, three, four, five, and you will be politician. You would say yes. Okay. Now have a look on a fighter aircraft going Mach 2, 1.5. Do they have a Laval nozzle in the rear? They haven't. Oh, that's the question. And the rockets have.
But they have like inside the engine itself.
Just imagine, it's a very stupid example. You are sitting in a train running with 100 kph on plane rails, and you have 8 kilogram medicine balls with you. And you are throwing them out in the back of the train. And you accelerate, related to the train, every of them to 20 kph. You are adding an impulse to the train with every ball. Will it accelerate the train?
No.
It will. Every impulse to accelerate the ball from 0 to 20 kph, it's an impulse. Mass multiplied by velocity. It will add an impulse to the train. If it's a very lightweight carriage, you will feel it. With the whole train, absolutely not. But it will accelerate it. In the moving coordinate system, you have nothing to do with the actual speed of the train. It's an impulse. You are throwing out a mass to the back, and it will give the same impulse towards front.
You can feel it with small curves. You can feel it with small curves.
Okay.
When you are driving the small curve, you can feel bump.
Okay. So, now the question. We are guessing it is not necessary. Even the Blackbird with 3 Mach had no Laval nozzle in the engine. It could make more than Mach 3. Why do all the rockets have a Laval nozzle in that case? How can you explain it? It's a very well engineering thinking to put a Laval nozzle on a rocket and not to put it on an aircraft. What can be the difference? What is the purpose of the Laval nozzle on the rocket?
There is no engine in the rocket.
There is a rocket engine in the rocket. I haven't seen any rocket without rocket engine. Big power. It may be gunpowder, it may be liquid, but it's an engine.
There is no fans. That the pressure, there is
no moving parts, but you are burning fuel and it provides thrust through that nozzle. It's a rocket engine. And all the rockets have this device and the aircraft's not. What is limited?
The height of the flight.
Of course, an aircraft flies in the atmosphere. Typically, normal passenger jets up to 11 kilometers. Best fighter jets up to near 20. The SR-71 was above 20, 25 maybe. And rockets can fly in the atmosphere, air-to-air missiles. Yeah, they are flying in the atmosphere, they still have the Laval nozzle. Other rockets going in the space, they have it as well. What could be the thinking of the engineer to do this?
Can I ask this question? How fast is a rocket? I don't know, like how fast is a normal rocket?
Even if you are building your own rocket to have a shoot up to 100 meters, it's better to put a Laval nozzle on it. It's independent from the rocket speed.
The pressure difference could be used in outer space because of the vacuum.
Pressure difference? Okay. It's worth to think about, but maybe try to think in a wider range. What will be accelerated in the case of the jet aircraft and in case of a rocket? A jet engine inhales air, burns fuel, and the most of the mass that you accelerate is air. Air coming from the outside. The rocket has every gram of the accelerated mass already in the tank before launch, yes? Okay, I just mentioned, I'm sorry, joke. The impulse we use to create thrust is mass times velocity. If you have a limited amount of mass to accelerate, you can achieve more thrust if you accelerate it to a higher velocity. So with the same amount of fuel, the rocket will achieve more speed, more height, or whatever. Okay? Or can carry more load. The aircraft in this case is not really relevant because you have unlimited mass of air available in the front of the aircraft. And if you imagine, okay, it's funny drawing, you have, let's say, a fighter aircraft, and to put a huge Laval nozzle to the back is maybe maybe disturbing for the air drag.
But for space shuttles, it's...
Yes, they are rocket engines. So rocket engine, you have to work with the given amount of fuel, and that's the only thing you can accelerate and create an impulse. It's better householding with the fuel. In the jet aircraft, it's absolutely not necessary to household with the air because it's for free. you have unlimited amount of air available for thrust. Okay, this is the reason. So try to show you the whole complexity of engineering. What are the reasons for made decisions, or what could be the reasons for future decisions? Okay. Now, next one. Here you can see the breathing organs of an engine. It's an old-fashioned two-valve engine, exhaust and intake. And it's a state-of-the-art four-valve passenger car engine combustion chamber. You can see the intake valves are always larger. What is the real reason to do this? Because if I imagine, we have typically the same mass flow through both valves, and due to the thermal expansion of the hot exhaust gas, we have a higher volume flow through the exhaust. So why do we prefer the intake side with that bigger valve?
Because if the exhaust valve was the same size as the intake valve, then it would burn easier.
What burning? What has burning to do with valve size? Burning happens at closed valves.
Yes, but if it's opened, then the more heat can, in the ambient of the exhaust gas, there is more heat if it's opened. Because then the burning or the expansion happens, then both of them are closed.
Yes.
And the heat, only the bottom of the intake and exhaust valves are touched by the heat.
Yes. You mean in order to protect the valve itself, it's smaller because it's sensitive against high gas temperatures?
Yes.
Mm. So we make it from a far, far more expensive material and can survive 1200 C. It's a good idea, but it's not the case. So you understand my dilemma. We have a higher volume flow, we have the same mass flow, but we favorize the intake side and put always a bigger valve.
Does it have with the losses something to do with the losses? Mm-hmm. As I remember, you said that there is a difference time difference between opening and closing, so we have a less losses when the exhaust is open.
Okay, let's say losses is you are near to the story. Opening and closing is not really related, but flow resistance, yes.
Like reducing the difficulty of the intake? Reducing the difficulty of the intake?
Yes, but why? We favorize now the intake, and we have to handle the same amount of gas.
Because it's higher temperature in the exhaust.
Okay, higher temperature means more volume flow. So we, of course, the original purpose is to have more air. And the engine performance is always proportional to the amount of air we can pump through the engine. So obviously we can pump more air with this constellation, but why? What is the reason, what is the argument, the motivation of the engineer to favorize the intake side? Very good, very good. So, what is the tensile strength of air? Can you pull it? The tensile strength of air is zero. You cannot pull it. If you want to fill the cylinder with fresh air, and it's a naturally aspirated engine, you have only the ambient pressure available, one bar. But not even that, because our purpose to fill the cylinder completely on the same level of pressure. So our dream is zero pressure difference on the intake side. So at the end of the intake cycle, our dream is to have at least the normal density air, ambient pressure in the cylinder, fully filled. Yes? it would mean 100% volumetric efficiency of the engine. Well, it's a good target. It's a good target. Because we know we have an air cleaner, we have a mass airflow meter, we have tubes and bends and narrow sections and so on and corners. So it will be difficult, but it's our target. So on the intake side, we have nearly no pressure difference available to generate the flow. Of course, as the piston accelerates downward, we will have a higher pressure difference. It will accelerate the air. And this air is going into the cylinder and the piston slows down. And we will regain some pressure. Okay, it might work. But it's hard to imagine that we can achieve ambient pressure inside the cylinder. At high air speeds, we have flow losses. On the exhaust side, it's very good. Exhaust side, we have a piston. It goes up and forces everything out of the cylinder. Of course, it forces out everything, but it will cause some losses. It's work what we have to perform. We are doing mechanical work to push out the old gas from the cylinder. So it's a loss, pumping loss. It's the correct English wording for it. So at the end, if we want to analyze the whole story, I just look all the definitions. The nastiest cross-section of every engine is typically the intake port and the valves. Just imagine you cannot open the valve like an electrical signal. You have to open it smooth and close it smooth. So in reality, I need to clean up the table. So let's say, as an electrical engineer would open the intake valve, close it, open the exhaust, open the intake, and this is 360 top dead center, and it's 180 bottom dead center, and it's 540 degree next bottom dead center. Okay, it would be the operation of a four-stroke engine. But we know we cannot do this because all the components have a finite mass and flexibility or rigidity. So we have to open it smooth, accelerate, decelerate, and close it smooth. Oh, sorry. Something like this. Okay. This cross section is missing. It hurts because it increases the flow losses. The port is not fully open. We have less restrictions and the gas exchange is not really fine. So what will happen? We will make a little longer event. We will have some valve overlap. If it has any use for us or not, we will see it later. We will have some corners where the flow might go in the wrong direction or cause us some losses. But the gain is a huge gain of effective cross-section. Okay. So this is the basic principle of designing a valve train. Here you can see very simple ways. It's a normal flat tappet. It's a finger follower operating the valves. And this blue and orange story, the first really variable valve drive system made by Honda. It was called VTEC, ValveTEC. And it was very interesting. These are the two intake valves of the same engine. The two blue lobes are smaller ones for low speed and low load. And the middle one, the orange one, is a higher lobe for more engine speed and performance. So, and you have three rocker arms. And if these little steel cylinders are in a basic position, nothing will happen. The blue lobes push the blue finger followers, they are opening the valves. And the orange one is making in the middle a bigger lift, but not touching any valve, nothing to do. If you push with oil pressure these pins in the locked position, the mid-orange rocker arm will lift the two blue ones from the lobes, and force the valves to the next rotation. We will force all the two valves in a longer and bigger opening. Okay, so you have more or less two engines in one. It was the first really variable valve train. It was used by Honda. Typically, the automotive industry is using a lot of patents, but typically they never buy patents. They just protect their own achievement and try to make the way harder and longer for the competition. So they have to invent another way. And if they have done a good work, it was a good one, the competition has to go a longer and more expensive way and will be later on the market. So this is the automotive way of thinking.
So most of the companies still using the normal one, right?
Yep, of course. And there are many different systems. Audi uses a totally different variable valve drive. They have lobes, the twin lobes on the camshaft, and they are pushing the lobes left and right. And there are two bigger and two smaller lobes in the same slider. It's very complicated, far more expensive, but this one was already protected. So basically, in order to control engine flow, the old engines, and if you buy a cheap engine like a lawnmower today, it's a big chance that you have this so-called SV, side valve arrangement. It's very easy because you need a gear ratio between crankshaft and camshaft, 1:2. For a four-stroke engine, and you have all the components in one system, so it's easy to make the tolerances between the distance of the axis and so on. So the lawnmower is made that way and it's fine. The disadvantage is, of course, that the gas flow is pretty complicated into the cylinder. The spark plug must be here, so the flame travel is larger than the diameter of the bore, so it will have a slow combustion. It has a huge surface of the combustion chamber, so the heat losses are high.
Even the sound.
Sound is nothing to do with that. But you will have a lot of unburned hydrocarbons because the flame will be always quenched near to a metal surface. So you have the compressed mixture in the combustion chamber. The flame starts at the spark plug, goes towards the wall, and very near to the wall, it slows down because the wall will dissipate a lot of heat, cools down the flame, and in the very last moment, it's killed. So the flame will normally never hit the metal. It will stop slightly before. Since that, it is useful to make the engine design in a way that the surface to volume ratio in the combustion chamber is low, because every surface what you add will provide additional unburned hydrocarbon emission. This was the reason Wankel engines died. There are rumors that somebody killed them and competition. It's bullshit. It's not true. Just imagine today, if we have a piston engine, we have a large bore and short stroke, the combustion chamber volume gives you a very flat disk. If you make it with a smaller bore and longer stroke, the combustion chamber will be that way. So the surface to volume ratio is far better. So today, state-of-the-art passenger car engines are all long stroke engines. So the stroke is longer than the diameter of the bore. Earlier, maybe in volume engine production, Fiat had a small 1300cc engine, the 128R. It had a bore of 86 and a stroke of 55. Was the shortest stroke passenger car engine I've ever seen. The only Formula One, the high revving naturally aspirated engine, they had strokes roughly 44 or something like this. So the pistons made a little alternating motion. So if you had the short block, the crankshaft and the pistons, and you rotated the crankshaft, the pistons moved a little bit. It was necessary to achieve 20,000 RPM, so not to have very high piston speeds. So it was the basic, then it was a big improvement to put the valves in the cylinder head. Of course, you can see the engine was very simple. The cylinder head has no tolerances, no moving parts, it's cheap, just a piece of aluminium, ready. This one is already more complicated. You have the ports, the valves, the valve guides, the rocker arms and everything. The dynamic of the system is not very easy because you have far less stiffness and more mass and moving parts. So at high speeds, it will not behave very, very well. But it gives us a far more compact combustion chamber and more space for the ports and so on, so it's far better. Next step was mainly motivated by increasing engine speeds to have shorter kinematic ways, simple rocker arms, no push rods and so on. And you could arrange the valves opposed to each other to have a cross flow cylinder head and so on. And for a very long time, the most competitive design was a double overhead cam, DOHC, with two simple tappets and the valves arranged in a V position. And it's very funny, racing engines has a narrow V because the compression ratio is very high and we require a flat combustion chamber. And stock engines has a wider, typically a wider angle between the valves. And today, road-going engines, these flat tappets are replaced by roller finger followers in order to reduce the friction at low speeds. Do you know, or other way around the question, you have this sliding connection between the tappet and the cam.
You have to adjust.
Above a certain speed, you will have no metallic contact, because the oil will separate the two components. It's the fully elastohydrodynamic lubrication. If the speed is lower and the pressure is high, there might be some partial metal contact. It's a so-called boundary condition friction. And it causes already some wear and increases the friction level. And if you have strong valve springs and low engine speed, let's say idle or slightly above idle, you will have boundary condition friction. And it will increase the city fuel consumption of the car at low speeds. So since that, today, nearly all engines will have roller finger followers. There is no sliding, just a rolling contact between the lobe and the finger follower. This is the reason. There were some very strange arrangement. It was a very fancy and at the end a very bad solution. It was made by Ford. They combined the OHC with a hydraulic lash adjuster to control the valve lash with a very soft stamped steel rocker arm. So it was a poor dynamic behavior, very complicated assembly to slide the camshaft through the cylinder head, through all the bores. It was a disaster. It was the old Ford Escort.
What is the exhaust?
Both ports are going to the same side on one face of the cylinder head. One intake, one exhaust, and typically many engines have the arrangement. You have one intake, two exhausts, two intakes, and so on, or other way around. It might be starts with one exhaust, next one are two intakes, in the middle two exhausts, and the same running groups. And let's say the wildest example of using pressure waves is a two-stroke engine. But before I explain this, just imagine a tube. You are sending a pressure wave in the tube. It's going through the tube. Okay, there will be some friction, but the pressure wave goes with sound speed through the tube. If the tube has a closed end, a dead end, what will happen? This pressure wave will be reflected as a pressure wave. Okay, with other terms, you are waiting for a concert. There is a long tunnel into the stadium and everybody is pushing and wants to go in, but the door is not yet open. The last guy on the door shouts back, please don't push, it's closed. So the pressure will reflect it as a pressure. If suddenly the door is opened, the guy can call, hey guys, come on, it's free. So in that case, the pressure will be reflected as depression. So an open end, we reflect the pressure waves in opposed phase, a dead end always in the same phase. Okay. it's the same game. If the tube is this type of diffuser, it's more and more cross-section, it will reflect the pressure waves as depression. And this conical part, the confuser, will reflect the pressure waves in the same phase as pressure. And the big achievement of two-stroke engines was this exhaust. And this is more or less realistic. It has the same size like the engine itself and will provide half of the engine power. Why? Because you can see the two-stroke inhales the fresh charge into the crankcase. And as the piston goes down, the pressure in the crankcase increases. On the top, after the combustion, the gas expands. But halfway opens the exhaust port. And you have to release the exhaust gas during a downward motion of the piston. So they're not forcing out like in the four-stroke. The piston is moving downward, and you have to get rid of the exhaust gas. So since that, if the timing is good, from this parallel tube, nothing will be reflected. From the diffuser, depression will be reflected. And this depression helps to make the cylinder empty, to get rid of the exhaust gas. It pulls out the exhaust gas. Okay. It helps to the transfer ports to have the fresh charge on the top of the piston. And now the piston starts to move upward, and you want to have a compression. The cylinder is filled with fresh charge, but the exhaust is still open. You will force out a lot of fresh charge. Since that, we are doing this confuser. It will reflect pressure waves and will keep the fresh charge in the cylinder. And it's so, it's really funny. In the wildest racing two-stroke engines, all the ports, transfer port, intake port, and exhaust, might be open for more than 180 degrees. So it's a hole through the engine. It's everything is connected. So the only reason for the fresh air and for the exhaust gas to go the right way are the reflected pressure waves. So the engine is controlled not only by the edges and openings, the same amount of control is given by this exhaust. So with these measures, before MotoGP came in, all the racing bikes were two-stroke bikes, and the 500cc naturally aspirated engines performed nearly 220 horse at not very high speeds, 14,000 or something like this. 220 horse from 500cc. Controlled by pressure waves. Okay. Yes? The main job, there are several main jobs. This part will deliver from the pressure wave a depression, and it helps you to empty the cylinder, to get out of the old exhaust gas. You have a lower pressure in this port, and the exhaust gas will go out. Then, after the piston stops at bottom dead center, and it starts the compression, of course you want to keep all the fresh charge in the cylinder, but the exhaust port is still open. It's more or less halfway. And now this reflected pressure wave comes just in time and helps us to keep the fresh charge in the cylinder. Of course, you require a very, many forward gears in the gearbox, high number of gears, in order to have always the right engine speed to have enough power. I guess you experienced already two-stroke motocross bikes. They're always gear shifting. Every 1.5 seconds, more or less. They have to, because this whole game works only at one given engine speed, in a very narrow range. Yes?
Already exists some kind of, it's called power...
Power valve.
Power valve, yes.
Okay. The power valve, typically, the most of them, will vary the upper edge of the exhaust. And at lower speeds, it will reduce the height. The exhaust will open later. And since that, because at lower speeds you have more time to get rid of the exhaust gas, you don't need the very early opening, and you will have a better compression. So it's the mechanical part. And both systems are typically combined in racing engines. Okay. That's a good question, thank you. Here you can see what I showed you on the blackboard. Bottom dead center, the exhaust opens significantly earlier, opens, closes, we have a valve overlap at top dead center, and the intake closes significantly after bottom dead center. Why is it so? I can explain later, but we start at the beginning with the gas exchange losses. Here you can see the PV diagram of a real engine. And you can see it's the exhaust slightly above ambient pressure. Then a huge pressure drop and the intake is significantly below. So from this picture you can see that it's a part load, very nearly closed throttle. The throttle valve is nearly closed, it's near to idle, you have a very low pressure in the intake manifold. And you might easily have the critical pressure ratio on both sides of the throttle valve. It means the airflow will go with sound speed at the edge of the throttle valve. And it's important. Today, you have an idle speed controller in the ECU, in the electronic engine control unit. It controls the idle speed. All carburetor engines haven't got this device, and they have a stable idle speed. How can it be? And the explanation is the sound speed. Just imagine you have the nearly closed throttle adjusted to idle speed, and the engine revs maybe 800 RPM. Now start to accelerate a little bit the engine to give a kick to the flywheel. Just increase the speed to 850. And what will happen? The amount of fresh charge is steady, will not change above engine speed, because you have the critical pressure ratio on both sides of the throttle, and all the air is going in with sound speed. So you have the same amount of air at 850 RPM or at 750. It means the energy for one cycle will be less and less if you accelerate the engine. You will have less indicated mean pressure, and the engine will slow down. If now you try to break down the engine running at 800 RPM idle, the engine rotates slower, the airflow is still the same, you will have more and more energy in every cycle. And it tries to pull back the engine on the same. So it's a stable working point without any outer computer control. Is it understandable? Please tell if not. So simple chainsaw, bike, whatever engine with a carburetor, we have a fixed position. It's adjustable with a small screw, fixed position of the throttle valve, and it will deliver us a stable idle speed of the engine because we have the critical pressure ratio between the both sides of the throttle. The critical pressure ratio gives us a stable airflow, and stable airflow, stable fuel flow, the same mixture. So it will not vary if the engine rotates a little slower or faster. And due to the steady flow of energy into the engine, the cycle energy, the available energy for every cycle, will vary. If the engine rotates faster, we have less energy in the cycle and it will slow down again. So you can feel it if you start such an engine and in winter time and the engine oil is very thick at the beginning, minus 10 C, the idle speed will be a little lower because the engine has more friction, but it can overcome the friction at a lower speed. And as the engine warms up, the speed will slightly increase, but still stable all the time. And the only reason is the critical pressure ratio between the both sides. Okay, and now the most important message of today is the typical way how to check and how to model and calculate the charge exchange of an engine. And it's pretty complicated, so it makes always sense to go through the diagram step by step. What is the x-axis? Is the crankshaft rotation in degrees. Typically, we use always 360 as the valve overlap, top dead center. 180 is the bottom dead center before, and 540 is the bottom dead center after. So the top diagram, red and blue lines, show us the valve lift in millimeters. You can see the early opening of the exhaust far before bottom dead center, and the late closing of the intake far beyond bottom dead center, and the small valve overlap. The mid diagram shows us the mass flow of the gas through the valves. The red one is the exhaust gas, and they are always positive if the direction is right. So that means if positive exhaust gas flow means the gas is going out of the cylinder, and positive air intake flow means the fresh air is coming into the cylinder. The bottom line are the port pressures. The red one is the exhaust port pressure, dynamic pressure, just before the valve, so outside of the cylinder. And the blue one is the intake port pressure, just in front of the intake valve. The black one is the cylinder pressure. So it's the last firing. Here you can see the peak. It was roughly 50, 55 bar or something like this, the peak combustion pressure. Now it's coming down through to the expansion. And in the very moment we are opening the intake valve, it drops very steep, and we have a significant flow out of the cylinder, even at standstill of the piston, more or less. So in bottom dead center, the most of the exhaust gas left already our cylinder. So you might ask the question, why the hell designed the engineer such an early opening of the exhaust? Because during the whole exhaust stroke, nearly nothing happens. The most is already out. So in this, at this engine speed, and now the residual informations, the engine is now measured at 1500 RPM. So it's the lowest operational range of this old-fashioned two-valve passenger car engine. It's wide open throttle, you can see. The intake port pressure is nearly ambient, roughly one bar, but the throttle is open. Very clear, it's wide open throttle. Is the abbreviation for full load in engineering language. And BMEP is a brake mean effective pressure. It's proportional to the engine load. It's just a figure, 8.9 bar or 0.89 megapascal. It's now a value. What we can see, the exhaust opened very early, so we had the most flow in bottom dead center. And since the intake closes very late, we have a lot of fresh air in the cylinder, and a significant part of it will be pushed back into the intake manifold. Is it good? Not. So it reduces our volumetric efficiency. We have less air, less power. It's not very good in this situation. And now the valve overlap. And you can see during valve overlap, the highest pressure is the exhaust port. The cylinder is below and the intake is below. So it means what will happen during overlap? Exhaust gas will come back into the cylinder and it will go out a little bit in the intake port, backflow. So it has no use in terms of braising of the engine. It's just a must because of this dynamic situation. If we want to close the valve exactly in top dead center, the exhaust valve, the whole lift will be smaller, and we are losing too much cross-section. And the same with the intake. So the cylinder pressure, if you count, are 0.3 bars, so 0.6, yes, 2.8, 3.1, and so on. So we have far above critical pressure ratio in the moment of the opening of the exhaust. So the gas will start to come out with sound speed. And this is the reason why we need a silencer, because it's heavy noise, of course. We are opening a pressure bottle, the combustion chamber, at high pressures, so the gas starts to come out with sound speed. It's a big bang. Okay. And now, the same engine at rated speed. The whole engine was designed for 5,500. Just have a look. We are using the whole opening of the exhaust. and some wonder, the fresh air is going into the cylinder despite the piston is moving upward. Oh, the only issue, we have still the backflow in the middle. So it was not designed in order to have a charge exchange already in top dead center. You can do it with racing engines, but you cannot do it with a naturally aspirated road going engine normally. But this corner is very interesting. And just have a look. In the moment the intake valve closes, we have a pressure in the intake manifold roughly 1.4 bar. Ooh. 0.4, 40% above ambient. And it's naturally aspirated. And we have losses of air cleaner, mass airflow meter, tubes, bends. So despite all the restrictions, we fill the cylinder on a higher level than ambient pressure. How can it happen?
Because of the inertia of the air coming into the
cylinder. Is one part of the game, yes. The air is going maybe 60, 70, 80 meters per second into the port. The information that the piston stopped and returned will go up only with south speed. And the air needs time to slow down. Is one reason, yes. But in this situation, the reason is far more important. This shape remembers you and what? It's some kind of a sinus.
Okay.
The blue line. It's this wavy. It's like a sinus. And it is. It means the piston accelerates downward. It creates a huge depression in the cylinder. This depression wave goes through the intake port, till to the intake manifold, through the intake runner. And in the point where the intake runner joins this plenum, this air chamber, is an open end. The open end reflects a pressure wave. And this blue one is the reflected pressure wave. The mirrored depression wave we generated. And this is the real reason for that very high pressure. So we can fill a naturally aspirated engine with a volumetric efficiency above 1.3, 1.4, if we have done a good job as an engineer. So we can achieve higher pressures despite all the losses, all the flow losses at the end of the intake stroke. Of course, you have to tune the length of the manifold properly for that engine speed. Is it okay? Now, you can see the same on the exhaust side. There was a pressure wave. The exhaust manifold have some primary runners. And in the point they are linked to each other, the cross-section is larger. The depression wave will be reflected. But just have a look. The wavelength is far shorter than on the intake side. What can be the reason for that? So, you are driving your car. You have a starting point and the target point. The time you need for this way depends on what?
Speed.
On speed and distance. It's the same. What can be different? Obviously, the exhaust manifold is shorter in a road-going car because we have to put the catalyst very near to the engine. So we have very short runners in a road-going car. So since that, the pressure wave is coming earlier. We have another difference. The exhaust gas has a far higher temperature, and sound speed is faster on the exhaust side. So we can see both effects. It comes very early. It would be great, and now just try to create a racing engine from that one. My dream, to put this depression wave in the valve overlap period, and to have it on a pressure level below intake. below ambient. What to do? How to modify now the engine? Okay, we need longer primary runners. It's nice racing style exhaust runner. Long runners to have the timing. But we have already the timing, but the pressure level is too high because the static back pressure of the exhaust system is too high. In a racing engine, you will use bigger diameter, remove the catalyst, the silencer, the filter, everything. So it is loud, but loss free. And if you achieve this, you can be somewhere there. Like this one, you can achieve a significant depression already in top dead center. And in racing engines, you will have valve overlaps more than 100 degrees, 120. Huge valve overlap and a huge valve lift already in top dead center. Since that, these engines will not perform at low speed. Typically, they have no idle. Not possible to run them with 1000 RPM because everything is open and it fires on both sides, will not work. But above a certain speed range, they will work very, very well. And why to open the exhaust so early? And now I have to make a drawing. Pressure, volume, let's say ambient pressure P0, top dead center, bottom dead center. If it's naturally aspirated, we have the intake, we have done a good job. We are going above ambient at the end of the intake. Now we have the compression, the expansion, and if we do not open the exhaust, we would end somewhere there, yes? If we open the exhaust earlier, we will lose a little expansion work. So it's not the reason to open it so early. But if we would start the exhaust from this point, the exhaust pressure would be something like this. If we start from there, it's something like this. And we had a gain due to the early opening of the exhaust at high speed, a huge reduction in pumping losses. So let's say at 1500 RPM, it was not good. At 5.5, it's very good. In racing engines, both the early opening of the exhaust may happen 88, 90 degrees before bottom dead center, halfway. Racing engine, very good efficiency, extremely good power. You use half of the expansion stroke. And you can close the intake more than 80 degrees after bottom dead center and the fresh air is still going into the cylinder. Okay, 12,000 RPM. High inertia and very intense pressure waves. Because the fast moving piston will generate at high RPMs a very high depression, a very sharp, intense depression wave. And it is reflected from the loss-free open end of the intake. It will create a very good pressure on the other end. Yes?
Will it redound the loss of the mixture, which will be burned because we open the exhaust valve earlier?
If
you open the exhaust valve earlier, then some of the mixture will not be burned yet. So we will.
90 degrees after top dead center, everything is burned. Typically, yes. So in a well done engine at high load, you have 30-40 degrees duration of combustion. At part load, maybe 60 or something like this, but even you start before top dead center, so 90 degrees after top dead center, you have no more combustion. But the significant saving of pumping losses. You have to make it empty very early in order to have space for the fresh charge. Okay. So of course the whole system, maybe I should show it at the beginning of the lecture. Here you can see you have bell mouse, you have an air cleaner, an airflow sensor, pipes, bends, the plenum, the throttle body, the primary runners and the narrow ports and valves. So a lot of losses, and you want to fill it with at least ambient pressure, so it's a big challenge. And you have to do a very, very smart work. And there were, of course, a lot of interesting devices and ideas how to improve this. For example, this one is, it was one of the first volume production switchable manifolds. It was the Opel Omega A with the six-cylinder 24-valve engine. And they had a split part of the intake manifold, one plenum near to the engine with shorter runners, and then a second plenum further away, or the farther away. And at low engine speeds, this flap valve was closed, and the engine worked as a three-cylinder engine. So the runner length was the combined length of the two. Long one optimized for 2,500, 3,000 RPM. At higher engine speeds, the flap valve was completely open, and you had the short runners for 5,000 to 6,000 RPM. And the engine could rev above 6, and then you could close it again because the second wave, the second harmonic, was used for very high speeds. So it was a very, very smart design with just one control flap valve. You could optimize the engine torque in the whole range. So I try to show it. Let's say the three-cylinder engine has this torque, the six-cylinder this one, and the three-cylinder, okay, goes up again. So these are the switching points of the flap valve. Closed, open, closed. It was the operational mode. And it's very interesting. We produced a similar system as an aftermarket tuning device for the first VR6 engines for Volkswagen. And we could achieve, let's say, a torque curve like this one. And theoretically, we provided a little control unit for the flap valve. And normally, you think as an engineer that in order to have the best acceleration, you have to switch in this point, to have always maximum power. And if you want to sell it, you will do it in that point, that way. You will lose that amount of torque, and all the customers are your friends.
So they can feel the difference.
He built in the system on Saturday, invites all his friends on Sunday morning on the German motorway. Hey guys, just observe. I do not know, 4,500, just feel the kick. If you do this switching point, there is no kick. You have the better acceleration, but no kick. With this one, yes. And you are selling emotions. The most of the chip tuners in Germany, in the time of naturally aspirated cars like BMW, all of these cars had already NOx sensors. There was no way to increase the power by doing something in the chip, because you had no more airflow. The fuel was controlled by the HEGO sensor, and the ignition by the knock control. So they just calibrated the tachometer, the speed display of the car, a little higher, and sold the chips for 600 Deutschmark. They all became rich. It's part of the engineering, guys. I have never sold any chips, never done any chip tuning. It's a very risky area for a serious company because you might have all the warranty issues, knocking combustion, destroyed engines, and so on. Today, of course, turbocharged engines can be tuned by chip tuning because you add more boost pressure and more fuel and you will have more power. So I have seen already cars where the clutch couldn't carry the increased torque. And you have had to avoid at max torque to wide open throttle position because the clutch slipped away. So you have to replace the clutch and then to adjust all the components of the drivetrain. This one is a famous old Hungarian story. at the beginning of turbocharged truck and coach engines, the turbochargers were not very sophisticated. You had a big turbo lag, so 2-3 seconds to have the rated power or torque. So one of the leading engineers in Hungary invented a combined system. So he created a resonance type, let's say supercharging or forced induction to increase the airflow at low speeds by this induction system, and to increase the airflow by the turbocharger at higher speeds. And it was bought by Mercedes-Benz and he became rich. It was a very, very interesting patent to that time. Of course, today the turbochargers are better. They have a better efficiency and boost pressure in a wider range. We might use sequential two-stage turbocharging and all these ideas. Okay, just have a look. Exhaust system is just a few explanations. You need typically, and it's more difficult in east-west arrangements, so where the engine is in a crossed position to the driving direction of the car, because in the conventional car with longitudinal engine, you have the prop shaft to the rear axle, and the maximum torque on the engine is the torque of first gear. Engine torque multiplied with the first gear. If you have east-west constellation, is the maximum engine torque multiplied with first gear and multiplied by differential, the main gear ratio, another 3 or 4. So very high torques on the engine. It requires a very stiff engine mounting. It's harder to make it quiet and soft NVH and good acoustics. And the exhaust will be tortured because the engine will move and the exhaust goes straight to the back. So you need typically in those cars always these flexible elements to avoid cracking in the exhaust. Then you need silencers, mufflers, and all the stuff. So, and now, another very important part. What we discussed till now is the primary air charge motion, the main motion to have the fresh air in and the old exhaust gas out. But for a good combustion and for a good mixture formation, we need the so-called secondary air charge motion, some rotation, swirls, or whatever in the fresh air. But from that, the first one, the swirl, in German Drall, was used very early because it's more or less natural. All the earlier engines were two valve engines, one intake, one exhaust, the cylinder. And due to the eccentrical position of the intake, you had always some tangential motion and some swirl in the engine. And it was used both in diesel and gasoline engines. Later on, it turned out it is not very useful in gasoline or gasoline. And it's essential for diesel engines, since that on my picture, you can see the typical diesel combustion chamber. This is widely used on diesel engines. The other story, tumble, even Germans use the English wording tumble, is totally different. A swirl you can achieve through the, due to the eccentrical arrangement of the port, and you can make like a snail house in the port, and you can even increase it. And the function is very easy. You have the injected fuel sprays, and you try to use the cleaner in between to mix it up with the fuel, to rotate it, in order to achieve the best usage of the air. So diesel engine lives from air excess, and the maximum we can use is lambda 1.3, roughly, because below lambda 1.3 it will smoke. It will provide too many particulates. I always mention the American tractor pulling with diesel engines. You can see diesel engines with lambda 1 is a black, that is not smoke, it's more or less a solid body coming from the exhaust. It's nearly really black smoke. In diesel engines, of course, most of them have in the meantime 4 valves. So it was very tricky to create a swirl, because the one port creates left-hand rotation, the other port right-hand rotation, they are killing each other. So state-of-the-art diesel engines has typically these configurations that both ports are giving the same kick to the air, or even this arrangement, that you have a strong swirl in the combustion chamber. Tumble will be created by the straight flow and by the sharp bend of the inner side. At higher air speeds, the flow will separate. And this was the story I mentioned. Sometimes we will that the flow separate. The separated flow closes the lower side of the valve, more or less. There is no more airflow. Since that, you will have this global horizontal rotation in the chamber. The swirl is rotating all the time. During intake, during compression, and even in top dead center, you are forcing the whole air on a smaller diameter, typically half of the cylinder diameter or even less. What will happen with the rotational speed if you force it to a smaller diameter? Why? Which force or where is the energy coming from to increase the... Is it? Okay, you have a smaller diameter, you have less inertia, so the same kinetic energy will give a higher speed, rotational speed. Or you can explain it with the Coriolis force. If you have a rotational field and the motion to the center, you will have the Coriolis force. If you are figure skating, making a pirouette, you always start with your arms to the sides. If you pull them to your body, you will feel the force, the Coriolis force, and you will speed up. When this happens, so half diameter, double speed. And this helps to create a good mixture in the diesel, but it's still a rotation. The tumble will behave totally different because at the beginning you have the space for the rotation, halfway you still have the space for the rotation, but in top dead center you haven't. So the two flow directions are too near to each other, and you will have a big field of turbulences, of vortexes, thousands of small vortexes. And it's very good because normally you had already the fuel and the air a little bit mixed, and now it's perfectly mixed. And this residual turbulence will give you a faster combustion because you will not have a laminar flame front, but you have a turbulent flame front, which is far faster. Faster combustion is good for efficiency and good for a lot of things. And this was invented more or less by accident. So racing guys and Honda with a small 800cc cars revving 8,000 RPM introduced four-valve engines in passenger cars in the 60s. And a little later, all people realized, or engineers, that is not only the benefit of better braking at high revs, and to be honest, the most people never rev above 2,000 RPM under normal driving, and you have absolutely no benefit from the larger cross section of the two and other valves. But it is better. So people realized you can make a higher compression ratio without knocking in the most cases. And engineers are simple guys, so they explained it because in a two-valve engine, typically the spark plug is somewhere on the side and you have a long flame travel. You have to ignite early to have the combustion in the right position. In a four-valve engine, two exhaust, two intake, you have the spark plug in the middle. The maximum flame travel is just the radius of the cylinder and not the diameter. And faster, better, okay, we have understood. Absolutely not. The real reason was some engines had already some tumble by accident, and they had a really fast combustion. And later on, it was invented, realized, and developed and proposed. And this improved the engine significantly. But it was used only on four-valve engines. And we had the opportunity to design a very cheap engine for Ford Brazil. The Rokem engine is maybe not more in use, but was in use for a very long time. And we had the opportunity to develop a completely new two-valve combustion process. And it turned out that it makes far more sense to increase a little tumble than swirl. Because swirl, due to the rotation of the whole air, will increase the wall heat losses because you have more speed difference between the charge and the cylinder wall and cylinder head. And the heat transfer coefficient goes up. And to be honest, if you have an intake manifold or port injection, the air and fuel are going into the cylinder, and if they are going around, it will not cause significant mixture improvement, because they can go together the same way. If you have this situation, it will be perfectly mixed. So tumble is far more efficient for gasoline engines. It's very useful. And now the whole story will be different, because what happens? Just imagine an old diesel engine. It is now converted for hydrogen combustion. And it will happen. All the truck companies are developing already hydrogen combustion engines, because we are thinking about hydrogen. The motivation is the fuel cell. But to be honest, if we had green hydrogen at the filling station, we would use it in a combustion engine, because it's far cheaper. And the emission situation is comparable, so completely, let's say, more or less free of emissions, the hydrogen engine. And the hydrogen behaves completely different, because, let's say, if you inject it into the cylinder and you have a high swirl, the density of hydrogen is extremely low. So due to the rotation, it will not distribute, it will be centralized. You understand? In a centrifugal field, the low density hydrogen will go into the middle and will not distribute. So a totally different type of mixture formation is necessary for hydrogen. You have to inject it very deep. In case of fuels, liquid fuels, we do not want to inject very deep, because the danger, we are hitting the piston, the liner, or whatever, and it will cause a big mess if we hit the metal with the injection. It will give us soot emission and hydrocarbons and washing down of the lubrication film and piston seizure. It's a disaster. With hydrogen, we have to go deep, because it has low inertia, and it's not easy to send it deep into the combustion chamber. So hydrogen with high pressure and with a focused beam, at least deep in the chamber, is now the new way to create a hydrogen engine. And here you can see different types of intake ports. Is let's say the filling type for good flow and less tumble, and this one is a poorer flow but extremely high tumble. And of course, with turbocharging, you are not so interested on high flow rates, because you can add some boost pressure and you have enough flow and enough volumetric efficiency. But you are interested in extremely fast combustion, because the turbocharged gasoline engine is always limited by detonation, knocking combustion. And to avoid knocking, it's better to have a fast combustion, because if the combustion is fast, you can ignite later and you have less risk of knocking. So the Formula One is a real challenge. The state of the art, the today's the now used Formula One engines, because they are limited in fuel flow, so you have to run them with a lean mixture. But you want to have a high boost pressure for high power. You want to have a high compression ratio, because the amount of fuel is limited, so you need a good efficiency, and you want to have a fast combustion. Oh. And lean mixture is burning slow. So it was the biggest challenge from 2014 on. And the solution was, and in a first step, to create an extremely intense tumble. So the tangential speed of the tumble flow in the cylinder is roughly 100 meters per second. So it's 360 kph in the cylinder. It's going faster than the car itself. Extremely intense tumble. And the next step, a mixture of, let's say, lambda 1.5 or 6, you cannot ignite with the spark. So, since that, there is a small metal cap on the spark plug with some drillings. Few drillings are important, because the direct injector is near to the spark plug. And during injection and compression, fresh mixture will be pressed into this cap. The spark will ignite it. And through the other holes, directed to everywhere, there's sharp flame coming through these holes and igniting the mixture in hole depths on several spots. And since that, the combustion will be extremely fast, even with the lean mixture. So So the main chamber is ignited by flames and not by spark. And everywhere. The same time. And this was the solution, and Mercedes was the best in the early development. They have won the first 7 titles, I guess. With their engine now, Honda is on the same level or maybe even better. It was very, very interesting development. And of course, there are people working to adopt this technology for road-going engines, but it's difficult at low speeds. So it works wonderful at high speed, but not so well at low speeds. So it's still under development. So, okay. Should we go through the control questions? We still have a little time, or not? Or you can read it and ask me if you do not have the right answer. Yes? Okay. Up to you. I can stop. We are ready with today's lecture. Or if you want, you can read it and ask it. Or if you want, I can explain it.
First one.
Okay, do you have the explanation for it? How do you see?
Energy.
How can you judge it or find it out? Rho multiplied by V square. V square is kinetic energy. Very clear. Okay.
Second one is no.
Absolutely not. Bernoulli is valid for not compressible flows. And as a matter of fact, air is always compressible. So the Bernoulli is really valid up to 0.3 Mach, typically. 0.3 is absolutely fine. So in the engine, we can work with it. With a transonic or supersonic aircraft, not. The critical pressure ratio is the pressure ratio where the speed is already
above.
Not above, like sound speed. In the narrowest cross section, you can go above. You cannot go, never. So it's the pressure ratio of achieving sound speed, yes?
How can you reach supersonic low speed?
With the Laval nozzle, via one rockets, we explained. Why do we use valve overlap in naturally aspirated engine? If it's a road going, not a racing engine. A valve overlap. We had only backflow.
In the middle, yes.
The valve overlap. Exhaust is still open and intake is already open.
To get some?
We might use it for internal exhaust gas recirculation on purpose, yes. In some engines, you have adjustable cams with a hydraulic or electric device, and you can rotate the cams together to have a longer overlap and to have internal EGR, and you will have a lower depression in the intake manifold. You can reduce the throttle losses, the pumping losses. It's fine at part load. But normally, the only purpose is to elongate the events to have enough cross-section, and it has a mechanical reason and has no benefit for a road-going engine. In racing engines, it's different, because in a racing engine, we can generate such a deep depression wave coming back from the exhaust that we start the air charge already in top dead center. The significant positive airflow already in top dead center. Okay? List the gas exchange losses. The pumping in two phases. The intake losses. And the pumping out. Pumping in, pumping out. The both, these two. If you have a look on the gas exchange diagram, how can you estimate the engine load? We made it. Can go back. Okay. So the intake air pressure is roughly ambient. So it means wide open throttle. And here you can see somewhere. Oh, it was other way around. Sorry. Here you can see a part load position. The intake manifold pressure is significantly lower than ambient. So it's the okay. Intake is okay. What's the motivation behind the use of secondary air charge motion? There are two main motivations. One is to improve. To homogenize the mixture, to improve mixture formation. And the second one is to accelerate combustion. Two different purposes. Okay.